This is Life Zero, Episode 13, The Russian Science Teacher. Special guest, Kirsten Sanford, Dr. Kiki. You were going to talk a little bit about your travel to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hear about that. You went to Russia.
I did go to Russia. Yes, it was an exciting, exciting journey. I went to Russia to act as a science teacher for Russian university students in the sciences who were in this semi-immersive English program for 3 weeks. And so I got to play English teacher, but not be an English teacher. Kind of get to know a whole new group of students. I had, was taken out of my normal work on the computer, be on the internet, be part of like this whole media revolution reality that I'm in constantly all the time. And I was sent to the forest. Yeah.
So where were you exactly?
I was in Moscow for 1 day and then got on a train and went out. Went to a town called Tambov, and then we got in a van and were driven 40 minutes outside of Tambov to a sanatorium or a health camp.
Did you have to wear hoods in the van, or did they let you see where you were going on the way out there?
I did not have to wear hoods, yeah. So I got to see lots of farmland and interesting housing construction and, the just differences in the way that, they use the land and everything is done over there. And it was neat. It was neat to see the transition from big city to little city to village to country and to be, to go to these different places and then to be immersed in a pine forest campground for 3 weeks. It was a beautiful location. It was on a river, and it was so there's pine trees and there were cabins all around, and we had a dormitory. Like, it was dormitory style living for our group, and so it reminded me a lot of college, actually, like where the students lived in these little 4-person suites, and I got one of the suites, but I got it to myself because I was a teacher. So it was good. But being out in the country, there was like no internet. There very, very slim access to internet. And so as a result, I was, limited. There wasn't the normal television. I couldn't get on the internet to download any videos. I was limited to what media I brought with me.
Yeah, we sort of missed you on Twitter for a while there.
I know. I disappeared. I came back and a couple of people were like, I thought there was something wrong. I was worried about you. I thought that was rather sweet.
You mentioned that it was camp-like. Was the focus, did you do any lab work, or was the focus just on the discussion of topics in English?
Discussion. Okay. So there was no lab work. It was all various topics in the sciences. And I kind of focused on... I thought that I had a really neat slant on science. I decided to focus my curriculum on what it is to be human and base that on contemporary issues in the sciences. So I had 5 lectures with the students, and in the first lecture or discussion, it was kind of like a journal club. They would read articles, and then we would discuss them and ask questions and do in-class exercises and presentations and stuff. The first lecture was on human evolution, and there was kind of controversy within the sciences. And so we discussed The Hobbit, which is this skeleton that was discovered at an island in Indonesia. And it's this group of skeletons that were found in a cave, and they're very small. And some scientists are saying, oh, they're just pygmy humans. Other scientists are saying they're an entirely new species of humans that have never before been found. Mm-hmm. And another group of scientists are saying, oh, no, they're a subspecies of humans. And so there's like this debate raging within the scientific community. And it's really interesting and important because the bones are relatively recent within evolutionary history. So the bones were dated to about 18,000 years ago, which that's like really significant in terms of having living cousins, basically, within the Homo genus. And so anyway, we got into the whole conversation about human evolution, what it means to be human, all these kinds of things. The second lecture I got, what was the second lecture on? Second lecture was on genetics and epigenetics, and so what it is that controls being human. The third lecture was on robotics, and so, you know, with robots, are we trying to play God and, you know, create something that's like human, and what do robots make us think about and question about being human? And then climate change put us in the place of our planet and what it means to be human on this little blue marble in space. And then the final lecture was on space and on the birth of stars and the universe and the formation of planets. And so kind of take us from, you know, the essence of humanity all the way out to, you know, our place in the entire universe. And so we got into some really interesting conversations on each of these topics, and that was cool.
Did you notice that since you were in Russia and their culture is obviously a lot different than ours, that the discussion steered in a different direction that you would have expected, or in a direction that you had not heard before based on maybe their culture or society being different?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of similarities. There are very many similarities, but there were also a lot of differences. And I think that the main differences is where in our society we maybe tend to rely on technology, they thought that was wrong. And so in the discussions about robotics and like creating human-like robots and creating robots that could respond emotionally to humans, that was something that they were, you know, a majority of them were absolutely against it. We said we should only use robots for industrial purposes. We shouldn't, you know, they should not ever become like humans. We shouldn't ever have to debate that question. And then in the issue of climate change, they were saying that they thought that we were doomed. Like, they were all very pessimistic. Whereas here in the United States, people are still like, "What's climate change?" You know, they all knew about climate change, and they all talked about it in the sense of, you know, oh, my grandparents and this, you know, they all knew what was happening within their environment. But then at the same time, they were very pessimistic. They were like, we're not going to be able to change anything in time. We just need to take care of what we can right now. But yeah.
Time for vodka.
Yeah. Yeah, so those were some of the interesting, you know, I guess poignant differences.
Did they have a sense of hopelessness, or did they have, I mean, it's you said that they were curious about what we could change right now. I mean, there's this kind of, I think there's this kind of mentality, or this sort of a distinctly American mentality, which is, if something is going to happen and it's bad and we can't do anything about it, it seems like we just throw our arms in the air and just say, well, that's it.
Yeah, no, I don't think they were hopeless. I think that they were just resigned to the fact that the climate's going to change and we may or may not be able to do anything about it, you know, but we, you know, they were not hopeless that, you know, we couldn't do anything, I guess, to help ourselves and to help our children. And so that was another point that they brought up. They were thinking much more in a long-term sense than I think Americans do, in the sense of many of the students said, well, we need to not think about, you know, here and now, but, oh, most people, that's all they think about, but we need to think about our children and our children's children. And so they were kind of thinking in that kind of long-term perspective. But they also were like realistic. I guess that they're realistic. They're not hopeless. And so they're just, yeah, This is the way it is. So we will try and build things. We'll try and do stuff. We should try and change the way this, you know. But people are people. And so we're going to use whatever resources we use. We're going to do whatever we do. People are not going to change the way they live their lives. Once they have things and once they experience things and they enjoy it, why would they change their lives? You know, so they were just like, meh.
Very pragmatic, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that's more so it. I definitely didn't get like a sense of hopelessness from them. And in fact, they were, I think, I don't know, because of the way that their society, their culture has changed over the last 20 years, they're probably optimistic for opportunities right now. You know, they can be anything that they want to be. They can, you know, they can be a businessman. They can make changes. They can be a scientist. They can make money, whereas once maybe a person in their status would not have been able to, or, you know, that there's a lot more, I think, optimism, the possibilities. They know that there are more possibilities than they've ever had before.
What was the average age of the folks in this group?
University age, yeah. So about somewhere between 19 and 22.
Okay.
I think maybe there were a couple of like mid-20s yeah. aged people, but mm-hmm. mostly undergrads. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So from a practical perspective, did most of them speak English, or was there a translator for a lot of the things that you were doing?
So it was semi-immersion, so there was no translator. And I had been led to believe that the students overall would have a higher aptitude than they did, although there were several students within the group who were great. You know, they had a very, you know, they had a broad vocabulary. They had a great ability to use the English language, specifically scientific terminology, and get their ideas across. However, it was, I could totally sense the frustration of reading something. You know, I would give them a short article to read, and they'd have to come back to class to discuss it or present it. And I could sense the fact that they had read it and understood it and they thought about it, but then they couldn't tell me exactly how they were feeling about it. So we couldn't really, in some of the classes, have an in-depth discussion. And so many of the discussions with certain students had to be at a very low level, you know, not digging into the material very deeply. And unfortunately, even though they were, I could tell they were thinking about stuff, and I was like, okay, let's try and pull this out.
Yeah, that reminds me of a conversation Laura Lee had with me one time where she was telling me she used to teach preschool.
Yeah.
She used to teach preschool, and she was telling me that the four-year-olds and five-year-olds are really interesting because it's a point in which they can process a lot of information, but they don't have the mechanism to share what they're thinking, and so they just get really frustrated.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that, you know, that's what the terrible twos is, you know, this kind of frustration. But I think it really, I see kids around 4 and 5 get a lot more frustrated because of their inability to explain themselves or really, you know, clearly ask for something or describe something to you.
Yeah. And that was what was pretty obvious with many of the students. But there were, you know, many students, a significant portion of the students who where, you know, we had conversations as if I were teaching an English-speaking class, almost. You know, there was an occasional, oh, how do you say this? How do you say that? And, you know, a discussion of what would be the right word to explain something. Students of all different levels. So it was an amazing teaching experience because I wasn't just getting, you know, upper division undergraduates. I was talking with, you know, these students who were all very bright, you know, focused in a particular field. However, their ability to explain things was so all across the board, so variable.
You meet so many people I've met so many folks from abroad whose command of English is so much better than mine and everyone else I know for the most part that you tend to forget that, especially with younger folks, that there are still folks that don't have a lot of English in their in the curriculum growing up. You just would figure that by now it was, you know, the dual track in their native language and English, depending on their profession. But it's still not as common as you would think, I guess.
Yeah, and in Russia, it's interesting. Many of the universities, and most of these students had English maybe for 10 years. You know, English is a very it's a staple in the the academic curriculum of students in Russia, and the university that was near us, they in fact teach several of their core classes in English so that the Russian students are taking classes in English so that they can learn how to communicate and, you know, in a written and a spoken way in the field that they're going to be entering for their career. The Russians, like they see English as being the dominant language, and they're working really hard to be able to help people communicate. It's just such an interesting distinction. I mean, here it's an elective to take a foreign language so often, you know, oh, maybe I'll take French, maybe I'll take German. Right. But we don't have that kind of like rigorous, because we speak English, it's like we don't need to worry about other languages. Yeah.
I think that's changing a little, though. I know in college I was required to take 4 semesters of a foreign language to graduate.
You had a choice at which foreign language it was.
I did have a choice of which foreign language, and they offered nearly, you know, all of mainstream. I mean, it was several languages that I could choose from. And, you know, 4 semesters, you're not really digging that deep into the language.
Not 4 years, 4 semesters.
4 semesters, not 4 years. Oh. Yeah. So 2 years, basically. But I also know that a lot of school districts in Texas require Spanish because there's such a high Spanish population in Texas.
That's smart.
Starting at kindergarten, and they require Spanish through high school graduation. So they are taking Spanish all the way through. And most of these kids graduate fluent in Spanish.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. Good to know.
I don't know about the rest of you guys. Is anyone else fluent in a foreign language?
Not fluent.
Yeah. Not 100%
fluent,
I can get by.
Yeah. I mean, I speak a little bit of French, and it's ironic that the language I speak probably the most well, it certainly isn't English, clearly, from what I just said, but is Thai. I think that I'm more fluent in Thai than any other language. But it was because I was immersive, right? I went to Thailand and I was surrounded by hundreds of people who didn't speak English, or if they did, it was just such a small number of words. You know, basically, I could go to the market and I could get, you know, the numbers 1 through 10 and yes, no, and I mean, just a few English words. Supersize it. Yeah. The only thing supersized in Thailand was me.
Everything
else was normal sized.
I'm glad they're focusing on having American students learn a second language. I feel at a distinct disadvantage for not having, you know, at least either Spanish or Chinese or something like that. One of these sort of the other, you know, not second tier, but the next largest in terms of speaking population languages, Indian, I guess, for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, I think from this, I learned definitely that the best way to learn a language, although taking classes all the way through school is, you know, one of the best ways to get to that point of understanding a language, being able to speak it, immersion is really the key. And these students, they definitely improved. They learned a lot. I, on the other hand, because I didn't get to be immersed in a Russian culture, really, because they all had to speak English to me. I, as a teacher, was, you have to speak English to me. That's the way it works. And so I didn't get to really learn that much. Occasionally I'd say, how do you say this? And, you know, they'd tell me something, but it was,
Did you find that there was a lot of situations where you were talking or you were, you know, you would say something and then this kind of mini conversation would break out in the distance with them having a conversation in Russian to kind of explain to one another what you were saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did that become more prominent as time went on or less prominent? I mean, you were there for 4 weeks, right?
Yeah. I think it depended. In the beginning, the students were a little shy, you know, so I think it was probably a little bit of a bell curve.
I see.
Where, at first they just weren't really saying anything at all because they were just shy and not really sure of themselves, but then they definitely started helping each other out a lot more, and so it increased. Yeah, and I think throughout the program, it probably just it increased and then plateaued. I think they got to a point where I started speaking more comfortably with them. They started understanding a little bit more, so I probably ratcheted up the way I used the language and the way I spoke with them, and probably started using different words and terms. But then again, one thing that I used as a strategy was when I would say something, I would repeat it in several different ways, so that if any one word would be able to trigger something, maybe it would help them understand. So I'd say, so this word means, or in other words, or I'd say something several ways to make it more clear.
It's really interesting. Did you, when you were there, not that I'm trying to interview you here, I'm just really curious about it. What was your expectation going in, and how would you compare or contrast that with your expectation coming out? Because I imagine, we have this sort of idealized notion of foreign places. And I imagine going in, you thought, oh, this will be a certain way. And then you came back out and you were like, holy crap, I was totally wrong, or I was totally right. I don't know.
I was absolutely wrong about what my expectations were. I didn't know what to expect, but whatever I was expecting, I was wrong. I thought I was going to be like in a research institution. I thought it was going to be like regular classrooms and some kind. Yeah, I thought I don't know. I thought it was going to be
palatial surroundings.
Something,
you know,
I don't
someone
know.
Someone would feed you grapes.
Lots
while
yeah, I thought I'd be
duty.
Like more in a city. You know, maybe not at summer camp. You know, I got there and all of a sudden I was like, I'm a camp counselor. I'm teaching summer camp. Okay, let's change the way we're thinking about this. Mm-hmm. You know, as we started driving out away from the city, I'm like, okay.
The city just keeps getting further away.
This
What's
is going to be really interesting. Yeah. And then the students showed up and, I got used to the surroundings after the first day. And then the students showed up and on the first day there, we had testing. So we did aptitude testing so that we could place all the students. And I was expecting that the students were going to be I was expecting they were going to be scientists, maybe in their 20s or 30s, maybe like PhDs or postdocs or even research professors at universities trying to improve their skills. And I expected that their English speaking proficiency was going to be much higher, almost to being an English speaker level. I mean, I don't know. That's what I was expecting, and I don't know where I got that idea, because going back and reading the emails and stuff, I'm like, oh, this kind of alludes to the fact that they wouldn't be that good. But
when they said in wooden huts down by the river, they meant in wooden huts down by the river.
Yeah. When they said quaint in uppercase, I should have paid attention to that.
Yeah. Reality hit, and I realized the students were going to have a hard time, and this was going to be very difficult for the students to do. It was going to be probably one of the hardest things they had ever done. And it was also, I realized, going to be very difficult for me, to speak with anybody aside from the English-speaking teachers, the other professors that were there.
We talked a lot on the show about how travel, is a nice perspective jerk in most cases, even sometimes unexpectedly. But this is sort of a 1-2 punch in the sense that you're going into a foreign culture, and the experience that you were expecting to have, it ended up being markedly different. So you're doing the sort of double adaptation
there. Yeah, and then Russia itself with the Russian language, on the total of, I think a total of a day, 2 days in Moscow, one at each end of the trip, and one day in Tambov. The alphabet is completely different. They've got a Greek-based alphabet. The Cyrillic alphabet contains, completely different letters. Pi is a letter. It's P. There we go. Okay. P is R. Okay. and it's a running joke that American tourists come to Russia and they see pectopah, Oh, pectopaw. What's pectopaw? Well, P is R, C is S. And so you put it all together, and pectopaw is restaurant. Restaurant. Your restaurant is a pectopaw.
Nice.
And so everything, the signs are completely different. You know, it's just to get your bearings, to know whether you're looking at a grocery store or a bus station. You know, you have to be so aware of your surroundings just to be able to figure anything out, to be able to get off on the right subway stop in Moscow. Almost impossible. You just have to count the number of dots on the map. You know, unless you've prepared, learned the alphabet, and like prepared yourself with a few words and phrases. No, I was with a group almost the entire time.
Okay,
which made it, and many of the people spoke Russian, so it made it.
Were you all teaching, or were they representatives of the organization you were working within?
Both.
Okay. So there were a group of teachers doing the same thing that you were doing.
Yeah. There were four scientists and four English teachers, and then the director of the program, and like one or two other representatives. Yeah. So the few English speakers.
So I was interested. I mean, one of the reasons I was really excited about getting you on the show is, you know, we talk about Life Zero a lot. I mean, you went to a place where the language was different. The accommodations were different. Your access to the internet was totally different. I mean, everything about this experience to me just sort of screams out a kind of Life Zero-esque, you know, experience. So I was just curious, you know, well, A, in the spirit of being, you know, a narcissist or whatever, did you think about Life Zero at all while you were in Russia?
I did, actually. I did. I was like, huh. I think I put it together. I was like, wow, this is one of the ultimate experiences, and in terms of taking things out of your life and getting back to what is necessary.
Yeah.
What is necessary to be happy.
I mean, as you know, I had this similar kind of experience in Thailand where there's no internet except in cafes. And when it is there, it's so not fast. I mean, the idea of even watching a video on YouTube when I was there, which would have been 2004, which it just was kind of a psychotic notion. I mean, it just wasn't there. You know, and then the sleeping accommodations were very interesting because a lot of times for me, it was kind of a small, like what we might think of as a foam mattress, you know, on a piece of wood or on the floor, and then a mosquito net over it with maybe a fan on the outside of the mosquito net. I mean, that was a lot of the experience that I had traveling around. I don't know if yours was that intense.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that intense. I mean, it's definitely the mattress it wasn't a piece of foam. It was like packed feathers.
Oh.
But pretty thickly, you know, it was like four inches of pretty well-packed feathers, I guess, and then an old feather pillow. When I got there, at first I was like ooh, everything's kind of dirty. And then I was like, oh, screw it. I'm just going to sleep. I'm so tired. Yeah. I don't care.
Isn't that interesting how our first thought as Americans when we go to a culture like that, our first experience is like, oh, my God, everything is so dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you know, for me, being in Southeast Asia, it was dirty because it was mostly on dirt floors.
Right.
I mean, so yes, it's dirty. You know, people are climbing into a bed or, you know, having just walked around in the dirt, and a lot of times barefoot.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they wear sandals, of course. But,
right.
So it was just interesting to me to also have to jettison that kind of ideology of, oh, everything has to be, pristine. When I experienced feathers, I'm trying to remember where I was. I think I might have been in Prague. I can't remember right off the top of my head. But a lot of the feather pillows, the feathers still had this sort of stem part on them. I don't know what you call that. And so they weren't exactly this. Yeah, they weren't exactly the softest thing in the world. I mean, I remember laying down and one time having this experience.
They stick sort of, you in the face.
Yeah, sort of
stick you in the side of the head. Yeah. That was a great experience.
So you have to sort of fluff the pillow a little bit and like shake it.
Yeah. And pull the ones that are sticking out of the cover, you know, out of where your face is going to be, so that you're not sticking your face into them. Yeah, there was a little bit of that, but it was getting used to you know, not having any of my normal comforts, not having any of my normal patterns, not having...
What are those, by the way, your normal comforts and patterns?
Okay,
so... We'll start with chocolates. What's your favorite brand?
Chocolate. There was chocolate in Russia. I had lots of chocolate in Russia, actually, yes. One of the other English teachers, Michelle Fauché from Seattle, she and I enjoyed chocolate. We'd walk the half mile down to the nearest store for vodka, beer, and chocolate.
Nice.
And it was good. We appreciated very dark chocolate, so we would share our chocolate and vodka and beer. It was great. That was a nice experience, sharing. But yeah, comforts that were not there. So, you know, my normal day, it involves a lot of being on the computer, on the internet, contacting people, constantly being in contact. My cell phone, being able to call anybody whenever I want, text somebody to get in touch to ask a question, you know, or if I don't feel like it, I don't have to use it, but the option is always there. And that's, you know, to me, a comfort. And then also just, you know, the things around my house that my cat. I love my cat. you know, my hot tub. I like my hot tub. You know, you know, just multiple pairs of shoes, high heels if I feel like it. You know, like all the stuff that I've amassed, all those things that I normally have. Oh, I'm going to try this necklace today, or oh, maybe I'll put on this eyeshadow, or maybe I'll, you know, my nice bathroom, you know, I'll have a nice hot shower in my nice bathroom. In Russia, the bathroom, you know, the toilet, the tiles were cracked and the toilet was a little bit weird and broken most of the time, and the shower, like the hand thing, like I broke it off the wall within the first day, just touching it. Oopsie. And then orange water came out of the faucets. Mm. And so I had consistently, like, I had orange-colored fingernails, like, from whatever. Like, it was getting into my skin. Like, there was the metals that were coming out in the water. Those are the things that, not so comfortable, not so nice, but you get used to them. And it was... You know, it was good to be away from being in contact all the time, being away from my friends, my family. You know, within the first week, I was so lonely. I felt out of touch. I felt alone in a country that I couldn't speak the language. I could hardly talk to anybody. And the people I could talk to, I didn't know very well. You know, I just met them, so they were just new people. And so it's hard to be in that situation. And so it was lonely. And then over the second week, it started getting a little easier. I started making new friends. Things started getting a little more comfortable. And I started being okay with not constantly being able to talk to people and not constantly being in contact. And I started being okay with just being on my own. And so by the end of the trip, I think it really ended up being a needed experience for me to get back in touch with myself. And back in touch with me on my own without all of the stuff and the people and the contact that in this life I have associated with me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Did you find that when you spoke to other people, were they having similar experiences? Were some people really freaking out because they didn't expect what they ran into? I guess I'm just asking on the scale of you were with a group. On the group scale, were you at the far end of freak out, or were you at the far end of being able to deal with it? Because I imagine there's always somebody in a group, wherever I go, there's always somebody in a group who just loses it.
Right. And I don't think – I think everyone in the group was actually, you know, fairly – dealt with the entire situation fairly well. They were all experienced travelers or had worked in other countries before or you know, just I think that, you know, I thought I was probably the one having the worst mental freak out personally. But then, you know, I talked to a couple of the other teachers and they were like, oh, no, you know, I just feel like, you know, people hate me and the students hate me. And then, you know, it turns out the students don't hate you. They just don't know how to talk to you. And it's just, you know, you're a teacher and not a student. And so it was also this line of authority that was there in Russia. If you're a teacher, you're a teacher. And this was a very new experience for the students as well, because they don't have casual relationships in the way that this program was being taught, where it was very casual. You could talk with the teacher or the students whenever. You know, so it was different from what they're used to. And so it took a little while for everyone to get used to it. I think I did hear a story, though, from a previous year. There was a teacher who left, like, within 2 days. Like, they got there and saw what the place that they were going to be staying in was like. They realized the students were probably not up to the level that they expected. Hmm. And within a day, they were like, I need to go home. And, like, didn't tell anybody, just, like, went to the bus stop.
Wow.
And left. Just full on left.
That's pretty aggressive, given how far out it sounds that you were, you know, figuring out which bus to take to get out of there.
I know, like out of Albania or wherever. Right. Yeah, so there have been people who have absolutely freaked out. And I think normally it's from the scientist side of things, you know, the scientists expecting, you know, to be able to be university professors or whatever, you know, I'm teaching students,
right,
and expecting it to be a particular academic standard and then having that standard be nothing like what they were expecting, and maybe expecting that, you know, they'd be better taken care of and have, you know, better facilities because I'm a scientist and blah, 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 you know. So I think there's a certain, you know, I think maybe it, I don't know.
Certain expectation there.
Yeah, I don't know.
The information withdrawal one struck me in that it's getting harder and harder to find places that you at least can't get, you know, crappy in a cafe type internet access.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you mentioned the contact with folks. It wasn't that I really missed, you know, browsing blah 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 or just surfing around. It was that really close contact with everyone and the sort of up to the minute access.
Yeah,
that you seem to notice right away, and it's one of those where it seems like we're getting to a point where it's not just the play things that we do with the access to the information streams. It's the fact that they become sort of embedded in our lives in a deeper way than just, oh, isn't it fun that you can email somebody? We talk about information overload and getting too much email or having trouble keeping track with all the feeds and that sort of thing. But we are really sort of, at least from my perspective, we're getting very dependent on that closeness of communication. And really, you really notice it when you're either voluntarily or involuntarily cut off from that for any significant length of time.
Yeah, I definitely did.
Did you find, one thing I noticed when I was gone, and I was gone for a while, but when I came back, I realized, you know what? Nothing blew up. Nothing went totally wrong. Nothing. The world still exists without me participating on the internet and all of these other things. So that was kind of a shock to me. I just came back and realized there's not a single email that I received in months that was so important that I had to respond to it immediately. You know, I just, everything became so, like, I don't know, I got a lot of great perspective about just how nothing is as urgent as you think it is when you're just in the throes of it. When you're in the throes of it, everything is so important, you know?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, it became, when I did get the internet access to check my email, it was like, oh, yeah, that's not so important. I can deal with that later, or maybe I won't ever deal with it. You know, there were very few things that came through as being something that required my attention immediately. And it even, you know, thinking about, you know, I have started to change. I think since coming back, I think I'm attempting to change the way that I continue to use technology, to use all these new media things, pick and choose. I'm going to start being a little bit more choosy about what I do and how I do it and how I interact, because I think it's healthier for me.
Yeah, I was thinking about you a little bit today I think I probably sent out and received more Twitter messages today than I have in any single day since I started using Twitter. It was just one of those days. Something resonated with people and something resonated with me. And it was just this sort of furious, you know, back and forth of Twitterers and tweets, as it were.
But that's probably, you know, there's definitely, you know, there's a balance, you know, and maybe some days are like that. And that's cool. You know, that can be a cool experience for that one day of being like so in contact and being like, yeah, this is what I feel like doing and it works. But maybe, you know, on another day you don't Twitter at all or you don't email or you don't cell phone. And that has to be accepted as okay.
Right.
You know, and you have to be okay with whatever you decide to do.
Do you find that, you know, we talk about reactions. Do you find that the outside world, because I sort of noticed this, once you set an expectation with the outside world of your availability, if you don't maintain that expectation, the outside world is not very forgiving.
That's why my friends know I usually don't answer the phone. Because if I don't answer the phone, it's a huge surprise when I do. Oh my gosh, you're there. You're going to call? You're going to answer the phone? You called me? Uh-huh.
Do they just not call you or do they just leave a message?
Sometimes they just don't call me. Sometimes they leave a message. Usually now they text message me and then I know, okay, I should call you.
Yeah, I wish I could convince my friends to just text message me and never pick up the phone. It's such an efficient way of communicating.
Leave that on your voicemail.
Voicemail.
Yeah, I know people that say, I do not check my voicemail. I will not check my voicemail. I do not check my missed call logs and I will not check it. Send me a text message. Thank you. And that's that. And like, you don't send her a text, she will not get back to you to the point that she taught her grandparents how to text.
Is this person employed?
That's great.
Yes.
And does their job require them to pick up the phone?
They're a dentist.
So yes, it does. But they don't have to pick up their cell phone as a dentist.
They do not. In fact, they don't talk on the phone much at all because they're with patients all day and... Yeah. And yeah, so they don't like the bother.
So they have somebody else schedule everything. And
absolutely, yeah. They have somebody else doing, they have an office manager. They're a partner at a dental place. So she is somebody at the office who does all the scheduling and everything. And she does a lot of oral surgery stuff. And so, yeah, but I mean, friends and stuff like that. Just she will not respond to me if I do not text her.
You know, it was a different time, but one of my favorite people in the world, not just because of his... Grenade over the fence on his way out film, which was Eyes Wide Shut, but nice. Just everything else. Stanley Kubrick, obviously. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Stanley Kubrick had this thing where he would not ever, and I mean ever, talk on the phone. If you wanted to communicate with him, this was a different era, but you had to fax him. And so he had he had a fax machine where he would just receive faxes and you know, and then if he wanted to respond to you, he would write a letter and fax it back to you. And so this was his sort of way of keeping the, you know, the art of the letter alive because it's thoughtful and these other things, but it was a fax. I always thought that was really interesting.
It's fascinating.
I wish I could convince people, and I know there's really no way to do this, but I wish I could convince people who communicate with me to take a breath and treat an email like a letter. You know, when they're trying to communicate something to me, because I don't know if you've noticed this. I know it's certainly the case in dealing with eBay. When people write you an email, they just blast out like stream of consciousness, whatever the hell they're thinking most of the time. It's interesting, in the last week, I've had three or four different people email me with something that was just, I wouldn't qualify it as, or characterize it as hateful, but it was just mean-spirited. And then I wrote them back with a very simple response that said, you're being mean-spirited, and I think it's unfair. And you know what's funny? In every single case, the person wrote me back and said, oh my God, you're right. It didn't, like, I did not even think about that when I sent the email.
Right, because the email, it was allowed them to just blast off whatever it was that was on top of their head at that moment without thinking about the repercussions of how their words would affect you.
Right. It was so interesting. And so I like this idea of the hand, you know, obviously it's impractical in today, today's time or whatever. But in this day and age, you can't do it, Sonny.
Sure. You got 140 characters.
You got 140 characters. But I like the idea of forcing someone to write something out longhand or to type something like Kubrick did. Because, when you write something down and you have to take that amount of time to do it, you really are aware, especially if you're faxing it, you're aware of what you're sending over.
I think I'm still fairly old school in the way I go about emails. Like, unless it's like a quick response, like two words, I'll be there, or thanks for that, or, whatever. But if I'm sending an email to somebody, every email I write, email takes me forever, because every email I write is like a letter. I delete things, yeah. I go back and I change things, I edit it like probably 4 or 5 times before I finally get to the final version that gets sent out.
No, I think I'm of that generation where, because I got my first email account in like third grade. My mom set it up for me, and because my mother's in technology, and then my friends who's had a computer whose parents knew how to set up emails to them, and we would email each other. And in third grade, your writing skills are not exactly the best, so your emails to each other would be shorthand and small and simple, and grew up emailing like that. So my emails, a lot of times I don't actually do periods or full sentences. I write a thought, and then I either make a dash or just hit enter a couple times, and then do a new thought, and then either a dash or enter a couple times. So the hard part for me is I had to write a pretty lengthy email at work today, and I wrote it, and then I do scan through real quick just to make sure I don't spell anything wrong or put like was instead of were. Little stuff like that. I do check for stuff like that. I will. And as I read it, I thought to myself, wow, this is an email that I'm sending to somebody in a higher position who's essentially a manager. And it was like no capitalization and no punctuation. It was just like thought dash. And I was like, wow. And I gave myself like 10 minutes. I'm like, oh, I just need 10 minutes. I've really got to respond to this issue. And I was told, no problem, don't worry about it. Like 30 minutes later, I'm finishing up this email and I'm thinking to myself, does a comma go here? Because I don't write anymore. I don't write anymore. And I'm like, is that a comma or semicolon? And so then I find myself looking up online like the proper usage of a comma. Totally. And an hour later, I sent out a 2-paragraph email. That to me was like, maybe I should do a little reevaluation of my emailing tactics. Because if I'm going to be in a position where I need to do this again, I would not like it to take an hour. And I would not to have to look up punctuation that I learned in third grade when I got the email account.
That's a pretty widespread phenomenon. I have family members who, everybody's Jack Kerouac now. It's just streams of words down, and there's, the carriage returns wherever they felt like it, sort of thing. But it is sort of just the nature of the types of communication, for the most part, that are coming across that wire. It's not a sort of a lengthy discourse with each party taking their time to get their salvo ready as we have this long back and forth. But
yeah, I remember reading, I guess it was Celine is the name, Celine's Death on the Installment Plan. I don't know if you've read that. It's sort of it's what it sounds like. It's a turtleneck-wearing, clove-smoking tome that only that only a ritual roaster's hipster would read at this point. But it's the ellipses, the number of, dot, 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 right, in that book. I was shocked at how many times there, an ellipses appeared. And I'm struggling. It's funny. I struggle so much with email, because what I want to do is I want to sit down and write a really thoughtful, well-considered, letter to someone as an email. But then I'm struck by a couple things. One is, no one's going to read the email as if it were a handwritten letter. So the effort that I put into it is effort that only I care about, or only I am going to benefit from.
Right? In fact, you're almost guaranteed to delay the response, right? Because people tend to feel like when they do finally get something long, they either ignore it because they just don't spend any time reading the long ones, or they feel like they have to respond in turn, and it's going to take them a while to get that back.
Yeah, sometimes I'll write. So I don't do this much anymore because, like I say, I'm torn. But if I write something that's about a page or two long, it usually takes weeks to get a response. And usually the response is like, yeah, I was going to respond to this, and then I got, you know, all tied up, and then I was busy, and then I couldn't find the time, and then I finally found the time. And so here it is, a response. But the response is really the apologetic response, not the actual response. And so I'm struck by this other way of doing things, which is this kind of idea of, is this another Merlin thing, the fives? Or is that someone else who came up with that?
He has a site that's just fives.
Well, this is five sentences.
Oh, the five. I don't know who was there.
We should look that up. I wish I had actually thought about it more carefully because I do practice it with some frequency. And it's this idea that you never send an email to anyone. If you want them to respond to it with something actionable, you never send an email longer than five sentences. And it's stupefying to me how often that works. Just sending a five-sentence email gets you a response. And I have friends who actually say to me, if I ask them a question, they want one question per email.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with that completely.
Don't ask more than one question in an email. And I'm like, okay, what if, hypothetically, the questions relate to one another?
You know, if somebody sends me an email with more than one question, I will actually reply and put answers below, and then I will change my font color, not to like a gross color that's hard to read or anything. I'd say maybe from a black to a navy, and I'll do a different style of font, you know, instead of an Arial, like a Times New Roman or something. Just something that's a slight
trebuchet.
Change. Yeah.
I know you. It's trebuchet in Georgia.
I know. No.
You know, it's not Verdana, isn't it? Is that how you say it? Verdania? Verdana?
I don't know.
Verdana. I always said Verdana as well.
Nice. It must be a female thing.
Maybe. I don't know. But yeah, I try not to do something too jarring, but I literally, it'll be the question, and then I type in the answer. Question, I type the answer below. And I just put answers below. And, you know, that way I'm fully answering their questions. And plus which, they can read what they wrote and then read my direct responses at the same time. And I appreciate it when people do that for me as well.
You know, it's interesting that you do that because my generation, we're big on the indentation level. Do you know what I mean? Like when you reply to someone, it actually indents what they wrote, and then you type your reply without the indent. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times, the idea of changing a font or anything like that just seems completely foreign to me. Maybe it's because I used Pine for so long, and then Eudora.
We're still getting used to the fact that you can do anything but plain text.
I think
is the issue.
Well, the question also sort of becomes...
Oh, yeah.
It is not green on black.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Do you actually need to do anything other than plain text when you're communicating in an email message? I mean, you could send
Holy
a link to somewhere else,
this,
but...
Yeah.
I'm just wondering. I think
it helps for it to, you know, stand out.
I mean, it's not YouTube. I mean, you're trying to communicate something textually, right? I don't know.
Yeah.
I have friends that send me videos embedded in an email, and I'm just like, you know, like they'll send me like a Windows media file or an AVI or a Flash file or you get this too. Or my favorite is a fucking Word document that contains an image or a video. So I have to actually open Word to see a video that's inside the Word document.
I don't
document.
Have Word.
Well, you know, I have to open Pages or I have
when
to open
something
open
like that
Office
happens, it's usually something from like a relative, an older relative who that's the only way that they've figured out how to send something like that. And I'm always like, why? Why did you do this?
Everything's a PowerPoint presentation.
A PowerPoint, yes.
Are you, next slide, coming to our house for Thanksgiving? Graphic.
Nice.
Graphic of a turkey.
Of course.
One big turkey.
Or discuss a little bit the Vita Simplex blog.
Yeah, I was hoping to. Mostly.
I didn't get a chance to look at it.
I didn't either.
I can summarize it.
Okay.
And.
Yeah, I meant to, and then it didn't happen.
It's pretty straightforward. He's doing he's doing like kind of life hacky stuff, and he references the Life Zero rules, and then he kind of uses that as a foundation for what he's talking about there.
Oh, is it the guy who makes him Christian, makes the rules Christian?
Yeah, although he kind of
Did you see that post?
Yeah.
He got a little uppity about that, though. Somebody wrote him and said, "So is this just a Christian version of Life Zero?" And he was like, "No, it is not a Christian version of Life Zero. It is a modification of Life Zero." Rah, rah, rah. Oh, man, it was kind of funny.
That's hilarious. Well,
why is it that you wanted to talk about his blog?
Just, we don't have to.
I'm just interested. There wasn't any context in the email about it.
I just find it interesting when someone takes something and repurposes it.
Yeah.
You know, the somebody, when they wrote him and said, you know, "What's wrong with the original version of Life Zero?" I felt kind of a little bit of warmth in my heart there. Why wouldn't he just, instead of creating a whole new Life Zero, which has fundamentally the same rules.
The same rules, yeah.
Why wouldn't he just say, "I'm practicing Life Zero"?
Yeah, and this is my experience trying to practice it. Yeah.
I just found a little
Okay, that's a good discussion point. Yeah, we should talk about that.
Which he's kind of doing, but not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a... I'm not saying there only has to be one, but I mean, why muddy the...
There can be only one.
Nice. There can be only one.